The nature of outbreaks are that you percolate a little bit along and then you reach what we call an exponential fade. If you look at every curve, Chuck, it does this and then it goes way up. What we and Italy is an example of individual country that did not implement the massive type of containment and mitigation, and it went way up. So they're here now. They're really struggling. Our goal right now is that if you do nothing, it's going to do this. We're going to get more cases no matter what. What we need to do with containment and mitigation is to blunt that curve.
That was Anthony Fauci, the now famous director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, on Sunday's Meet the Press. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I am Matt Welch, joined remotely, version 2.0 of this podcast attempt, by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Hi, guys.
Howdy.
Hi, Matt.
Happy apocalypse.
We are going to resist the temptation to kick Peter Suderman and the privates in a moment, and also go straight to whether there are any the question of whether there are any libertarians in a pandemic. But before all of that, the show, it is going on. Freedom Fest 2020, the annual summit for the Liberty Movement, is here to remind listeners that all systems are still go for their July 13th to 16th conference at the Paris Resort in Las Vegas, Nevada. While Democrats and other statists gather in Milwaukee to flap their gums, the counter-conferencers of freedom are ready to assemble. Keynote speaker Dr. Jordan Peterson, for example, says he's raring to go to give his talk on the new cultural revolution. Early bird rates are still available. They run out March 31st. Visit www.freedomfest.com for details. All right, coronavirus, it's happening all around us. Usually at this moment, I would update everybody on the news. It'll all be hopelessly out of date by the time this thing is released in a few hours. The last thing that I saw that was kind of just personally poignant was the governor of the state where Nick and I live just said that he expects the health system to be overwhelmed. We didn't flatten the curve in time. Good luck. At least there's not like 8 million of us sitting on top of each other. So anyways, the Dow Jones opened up 2,000 points down. The death toll has topped 1,800 in Italy. It's in every state in the United States except for West Virginia. Arnold Schwarzenegger is petting donkeys. My kids are really doing a good job of homeschooling in the first 2 hours. There's been no blood shed so far.
There will be blood.
There will be blood soon.
And bullying. If you think the bullying is bad at school, Matt, wait until it's homeschool.
Catherine, your kids are homeschooling right next to you, which I'm sure is going to be fun. But now that you're home and have a more secure internet connection than the last time we talked, there is this weird tendency that happens, and I've seen it with this time too, at moments of high crisis to turn around and blame the libertarians, or at least just say that libertarianism has proven to itself to be useful in this moment. We see it now. We saw it in the financial crisis of 2008. We saw it after 9/11. What say you, O priestess of libertarianism? Does this expose why this philosophy is wrong?
Yeah, I mean, just as there are, in fact, atheists in foxholes, there are libertarians in pandemics. It is not to say that this is not a trying time for everyone's political philosophy. I think we saw some of that on display last night in the Democratic debate, which I'm sure we'll get to soon. But yeah, so we have this, A, it's libertarians' fault, because we're so powerful, as everyone who listens to this podcast knows. This is stuff like, oh, the Office of Pandemic Management was destroyed. The CDC has been defunded. By and large, those criticisms tend, I would say, to be a little off base or flat out untrue. But then there's the other piece of this, which is the, well, how can you still be a libertarian in a pandemic? And I actually have been interested to see some folks who identify as libertarians on Twitter, elsewhere, saying, you know, I'm not an anarchist. I am a minarchist. And this is a moment for intervention. I would like to make a distinction, though, between intervening to save lives versus intervening to do as both Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders promised, which was to make everyone affected by the virus whole. And so that means huge bailouts at the corporate level, bailouts at the personal level. That is where I think there is still a good use for libertarians in a pandemic, which is to keep calm and level on how much intervention we do in the economy.
Peter, there's a lot of interesting kind of comparisons being made. You see this in the Democratic debate. You know, this should cause us to think about Medicare for all. And then Joe Biden says, well, they basically had single payer in Italy. How'd that work out for you? There are questions of how much we spend per capita in the U.S. on healthcare versus other countries. And does that make us more or less resilient in the face of this? We definitely have been having a shortage of testing, which has affected things here. What has this crisis so far caused you to reflect? And of course, probably the biggest interesting kind of experiment is what's happening in Britain with the National Health Service and their kind of Boris Johnson's approach to this, which is very different than everywhere else. What has this caused you to reflect about the health policy differences in this country compared to others?
I think the biggest obvious takeaway here is that national health systems of the kind that Bernie Sanders wants, but also even to some extent that Joe Biden wants, don't prevent this sort of outbreak from happening necessarily. And so you look at Italy, you look at what is probably going to happen with the NHS, you look at Spain, which has also basically shut its borders, you look at France, which has closed down for business, you know, all of the kind of draconian measures that New York is taking in terms of shutting down schools, restaurants, gyms, bars, that sort of thing, places of gathering. France has done that nationwide. And all of those places have big government-funded healthcare systems, not necessarily full-on single-payer, but universal health coverage systems. And it's not stopping the outbreak there. And so you can say that the United States isn't handling things well, that there are problems here, that we have gaps and cracks in our coverage system. But you look at other places, and they have serious problems with this, too. And so trying to present Medicare for all or whatever your kind of favorite government, you know, universal government system is as a solution to this particular problem it's just not very convincing, because many countries with those systems are having pretty serious problems with COVID-19 right now as well. And in general, it just kind of exposes, I think, some of the kind of the uselessness of our political debates about healthcare, which is that no matter what happens, it's like you can't imagine a circumstance in which Bernie Sanders doesn't say, well, the solution is let's have Medicare for all. Let's have the government nationalize the entire healthcare financing industry. And so, you know, when that's the case, when you kind of can't, when he's going to respond to every non-crisis or every crisis or whatever it is with the exact same response, it is a little bit telling in terms of how he's thinking about it and in terms of whether it's actually a solution to the particular problem that we face right now.
Nick, there's been a few people to have noticed out there in moments of this, you know, acute impending crisis that, oh, look, there's this roadblock, there's this delay, there's this bureaucracy that's in between what we should be doing and what we are doing. And so let's get rid of that. Talk a little bit about some of the, at least, you know, individual libertarian lessons that are being learned, even if they're not being understood as such.
Yeah, if you look at, I a piece at Reason.com, I've got up called, Tired, There Are No Libertarians in a Pandemic. Wired, There Are Only Libertarians in a Pandemic. I point to three recent shifts in policy. The TSA is now allowing family-sized jugs of hand sanitizer on planes, 12 ounces rather than 3.4.
It's like a full handle, right?
You can fill your biggest
Jack Daniel's bottle
when you're measuring hand sanitizer by handles. Like, things ain't right.
You can, in fact, you can use a handle of Everclear, which is, 190 AB proof, so like 95 ABV or something, and that if it's 60% alcohol by volume, it kills it.
So the TSA is relaxing certain rules. The CDC and FDA have given up the ghost on certain types of authorizations and kind of super fast tracking cures that we are testing processes that we know work. The governor of Massachusetts has, blissfully allowed medical professionals who are licensed to practice in other states to only wait a day to do the paperwork to start working in Massachusetts. 34 states basically allow reciprocity of medical professionals, particularly nurses, to work across state lines. And Massachusetts has now joined, has joined that at least temporarily. What we're seeing here are people at the high highest levels of power saying, oh, these rules and regulations, which we swore up and down to you, are in place because otherwise chaos ensues. It's like, fuck it. You know, it's an emergency, so we're going to get rid of these petty ante things. I think that's a good sign, and it's a lesson worth remembering now and kind of, blowing out more. Like, what are the other stupid rules that are getting in the way of the free flow of information, goods, and services? But especially when this calms down, we need to go back and say, okay, so what were all of those things that people said in the moment weren't really that important? Because if they're not important during a crisis, they're certainly not that important during everyday life, when we have more ability to kind of pick and choose among things. So that's what I'm talking about in that piece. I think we need to go back. I think we have actually, without minimizing the threat posed by coronavirus to particular parts of the population and whatnot, we need to go back and say, like, why is Andrew Cuomo, why is Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York, dictating what businesses can open and close without, you know, real kind of more consideration of what's going on here? I think we've jumped the gun into a panic mode that is now not trickling down, but I mean, it's cascading down from the highest levels of federal, state, and local authority.
So I actually want to challenge that a little bit, because I think that another way to describe what's going on is that actually a lot of this trickled up. Like, this is the thing that I've been thinking about with the whole libertarians in a pandemic question is, you know, everybody, you say like, I'm an editor at a libertarian magazine, and people say like, but libertarians don't like rules. How do you guys do stuff? Right. And that's, you know, that's a pretty standard response.
So, yeah. Okay.
And
so what's
so
trickling
I think
up?
Like, in this case, one thing that's happened is a great example of like when you say we need to do something about this real problem. And the we is like people naturally think of it as being government. But in fact, lots of private actors, including individuals who just chose to stay home, including businesses, including sports leagues, they all acted with greater dispatch than the government, and then the government followed.
Absolutely, but the city...
And I think that that's
wait,
often
you're,
a
so
sign...
You're saying you support... Do you support the D.C. government or the New York City government or the L.A. government saying, okay, bars and restaurants, you're shut down, or you'll have takeaway food for a little bit and then that'll close? Or should it be, you know, that the government, and I think we were even talking about this last week, that the government can give all kinds of guidelines and information, which it's been really bad at all levels. We've gotten a lot of bad information from official sources, but they should say, you should, you know, here are the facts of things, and then let individuals decide. I think businesses, I think schools, I think other organizations at this point should be allowed to make those decisions about whether they stay open and under what circumstances. I think we've jumped into something approaching martial law without really making the case for it.
So I would disagree with that. I would disagree with that portrait a little bit. I would say it is my preference for all of this to be done via private action. But I think, as we discussed last week, I would much rather see it be private actors first, localities next, states next, federal next. And I think to say we've jumped into martial law is not an accurate description of where we are right now.
I said something like that. Where does it end?
I would also just note one. There's one small thing that we need to, or notable thing that we need to consider here, which is that for businesses shutting down of their own accord, often they can't collect insurance payments unless they are shut down by the government, and so they're in a little bit of a pickle, which is that they might want to shut down, but not be able to collect the insurance money that they would count on to keep open.
What about the ones that want to stay open? I mean, can we at least have some discussion of that? Because we're acting as if this is the plague, and it is not.
So,
it is not the flu, but it is not the plague. And we have gone in a week's time to freaking out and shutting things down. And we know it's only going to be shut down more and more.
So I think it's worth actually considering what kind of threat this is. And the way I'm looking at this is that there are projections out of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, out of the CDC, that suggests that 200 million Americans could end up infected, and that as a result, 1.5 to 1.7 million Americans could die. And that's like, the way I think about this is like an asteroid heading for Dallas, Texas, which is a city of about 1.4 million people, or heading for the Bronx.
If we knew it was an asteroid, that we would commandeer buses and everything, right, and we would get people
out of Dallas. We would take extraordinary and expensive action, and it would be unusual, and we would have to require a lot of people to do a lot of things that they might not normally do. And so, you know, I want to say I'm not super comfortable with massive shutdowns all over the country. That are sort of dictated by state governors and by city officials. It's not something that I sort of look and say, hey, that's great. At the same time, this does seem to me to be, I think you can make a case that it is an extraordinary event and requires an extraordinary and unusual response. And what I worry about, and this actually goes back to what you were talking about earlier with the 12-ounce things of hand sanitizer that you can now take on an airplane, as you know, provided that anybody's actually flying here. Think about that. Why did we have that rule in place to begin with? It was a sort of leftover response from 9/11. And so my real worry here is not so much what we're doing this week or next week or even next month. My real worry is that we're going to do dumb stuff that stays in place for years and for decades afterwards, and that the responses that we're undertaking right now end up not being temporary, but end up conferring huge new powers onto the state that get used in non-emergency times, and that after this, everything becomes an emergency. I think that there is, like I said, a real good case that this moment right now is an actual emergency that requires some suspension of some normal rules and normal expectations. On the other hand, there is also a real risk that we should be worried about warding off that this becomes a sort of semi-permanent state in which stuff is closed all the time, in which we're sort of in which we never get out of this because for the same reason that it took until now to be allowed to bring 12 ounces of hand sanitizer on an airplane.
If we weren't social distancing, Peter, you could see me in the booth doing a little like preach hand gesture right now.
So we know from past experience that these measures will not be fully temporary, including the massive bailouts that are coming from both Republicans and Democrats. The economy is going to be made whole. Businesses are going to be made whole. Medical laws, blah, blah, blah. Like, we know this is just kicking spending up into the stratosphere. I think we should fight a little bit more right now to question whether or not this is the moment where we say, oh, well, you know what? This is a real emergency, unlike 9/11. Unlike, H1N1, unlike communism in the 50s, I mean, into the 80s or 90s, California professors were still having to sign loyalty oaths if they taught at the University of California and Cal State systems.
I think that's still true, by the way.
These things are not going to be temporary. And I think we are freaking out over something which we can disperse through less kind of top-down coercive means than we're doing right now. South Korea provides an alternative model, which is an open society and is much more authoritarian than America, where they do mass testing. And that's the main way that they educate the population about what to do and also who's infected. Because this is part of the thing, is that we're assuming all of the projections, which are done with very little information, are going to take place, and suddenly we're up to 1.7 million people dying. That seems highly unlikely.
But let's look at
what's happening in Italy right now. Either Saturday or Sunday, Italy had 368 deaths.
What's happening in South Korea?
About 20% of the mortality they typically have across the country in a normal day to begin with. So COVID-19 is causing, you know, sort of a 20% increase, a 20-25% increase in deaths in the country right now. And
Italy,
imagine that in the United States.
It is an old country with massive numbers of smokers, et cetera. It is not, and it's also not evenly distributed across Italy. It's in one particular region, but they're banning they're quarantining the entire country and things like that.
That's because viruses spread, Nick. And the reason is because stuff spreads, and if you don't shut down the vectors of spread.
I'm sorry, like, it seems to me that if this is the bar for a shutdown of business as normal and of rights as normal in America, like, we have established a very, very low bar for what counts as, as freedom. And I don't think that we've reached that barrier. And I think by skipping over that, we are setting absolutely not only laws and policies that will be in place for long after this, but we are setting the bar for the next time a little bit lower and a little bit lower, because this doesn't tend to cause a reaction where we're like, well, we're not doing that again. It's like, no, we're going to do it again. And it's going to be triggered at a lower and lower level threshold of significance.
Well, let's help us through that, Nick. What is an example of an action that you see being taken or contemplated today, which could represent something that stays in place?
The quickness with which localities are saying, okay, businesses, you're shut down. You cannot operate under normal things. The theaters are closed. The bars are closed. The restaurants are closed, or they're constricted in significant ways.
But how would that look like in 3 years from now?
Every time there is some kind of a viral flu, and it could be behavioral, it could be something else. We're going to see calls to shut down things like the way that we did. So I also think that the government, if you think that this is not going to change the way in which we talk about letting people into the country or out of the country, it seems to me that's going to be a major concern going forward in ways that will ultimately be applied, not in the name of public health, but in the guise of keeping certain types of people in the country or out of the country.
That's already so those, happened, those, yeah. sure. Yeah.
Those are
I
my
would
concerns.
Though think that there is, again, a really important distinction between saying there are some steps that could be taken right now, which could reduce the spread of the disease, et cetera. We can talk about whether they are the correct steps. I think the South Korean example is interesting and instructive. But to me, the place where libertarians and where I plan to kind of hold the line and, you know, put my emphasis is on things that do have those kind of long-term effects, right? I think there's a very different thing to say, okay, from now on, we're being extremely restrictionist in immigration. From now on, we are bailing out every small business that has to close its doors for any reason for more than a month, whatever it is. Like, that's the place where we can have a productive conversation. I wish that we were in a scenario where we had a competent and also deregulated, partnership between governments and private entities to do testing. We had the opposite of that. And, I think that is one takeaway here, as I think someone mentioned earlier on the podcast, like, hey, if there hadn't been an explicit prohibition in place on some of the testing technologies and development that we really, really needed, all of this could have spun up a lot sooner from the private sector. That is the kind of thing where I think, we are also Bernie Sanders. Like, we should kind of cop to that. Like, we are also essentially just saying in this crisis, what we have learned is that libertarians are right about X, Y, and Z things. But the place where I think we can actually reduce the chance of the thing you fear, Nick, of this becoming kind of the new baseline for a response to a crisis is not to kind of do the kind of reactionary thing of being like, screw you guys, I'm going to the bar. And instead to do the thing of saying, let's be thoughtful about bailouts, financial changes, policy changes, regulatory changes going forward.
As part,
good luck, because next time we've already bailed out industry. I mean, do you think we wouldn't, we bailed out the banks after the financial crisis. Do you think that that's not influencing the idea that, okay, there are whole industries that should be bailed out because they're particularly affected by all of this?
Well, yeah. In fact, I think that's happening. President Trump, who we thankfully haven't even uttered the name of so far until I just broke the seal. One of the things he was saying a week or so ago was that, we need to help with our great cruise industries, as if we have any in the United States, because we don't, because of the Logan Act. But also, it's not the Logan Act. What's the Jones Act? Sorry, they're all bad. Yep. The acts, we should bail out the airline industry maybe, and the hospitality industry. And he's already mentioned that. And then certainly last night, the quote from Joe Biden was that we will need a major, major, major bailout, so major cubed bailout. So exponential thinking is with us on that topic specifically, Peter. And we talked about this in the version 1.0 of this podcast, which got junked, is so there's an idea. Let's do a big bailout, or let's, you know, cut the Federal Reserve rate by another 50. We're down to between 0 and 0.25% on Fed rates. And we've been spending money like nuts over the last 10 years. Talk a little bit about how the behavior leading up to this point, the macroeconomic policies leading up to this point, have perhaps limited what can be done on a macro level by the politicians who want to do a major, major, major bailout.
It's much harder to respond to a crisis where you might, say, want to spend some money very quickly when you have already spent all of your money. And then a lot more, which is what the United States has done. We're running $1 trillion deficits now. We are set to run $1 trillion deficits for the next decade. That was assuming that things were going to go well or well enough with the economy. We have 20-something trillion dollars in debt. And what the Congressional Budget Office in its, you know, regular reports on this always says is, you know, in some sort of very calm and kind of, you know, low-key bureaucratic language, that's a really bad idea. When you get to an actual crisis, because in a crisis, what you want to have is flexibility. You want to have the ability to make big, bold decisions, enact unusual policies. And so, you know, if let's say that let's just forget for a second that let's table for a second some of the libertarian objections to big spending fiscal responses right now, and just say that like you thought this was a huge emergency that did demand a really big response. It's going to be a lot harder because of the debt and deficit situation, because our budget has been so hosed for so long. And so if you wanted to do that, this will make it much more difficult. And if you think of big deficit, deficit expanding things as policies that should only be enacted in genuine crises, what we've done is the opposite. We have run up the deficit in boom times when there isn't a crisis. And now we're in, I think, I think this is an actual crisis. I think this is a quite unusual situation. And it is going to constrain our ability to respond with fiscal policy in particular. And, you know, if you might ask, in the original version of this podcast that we scrapped, Nick asked, well, how exactly does it constrain us? And the answer is that it's just much harder to turn a ship when it is weighed down. We are already doing so much that trying to add something else to what we do, that trying to spin up a new program to try and trying to do any sort of thing that is different than what we're already doing is just going to be a lot harder. And I think that while we may end up passing some sort of big bailout bill, probably badly targeted, probably the kind of thing that won't end up making a positive difference in a lot of ways, like the 2009 stimulus that we passed under Obama, like the stimulus that we passed under Bush. This is the thing that people forget a lot, is that under President Bush, not TARP, before TARP actually happened, we passed a $150 billion stimulus program that wrote $600 checks to most Americans. Those stimulus plans didn't work very well. And I think that even if we get something where it's probably going to be along those lines, but it's going to be a lot harder to do anything that is smart, anything that is targeted, anything that is big, and anything that kind of responds to an actual emergency now that we are in that situation.
I agree with you, Peter, that it won't have the effect that it's intended to. It won't stop people from it. I mean, there is no upper bound on the amount of money that the government will print or create and pump into the economy. It won't have the effect. It's the last bit of insulin after a huge binge or something like that. But and that's what worries me, both on the economic side, but then also on the social and the public health and the larger kind of libertarian side of, you know, what are the bounds? What are the constraints of government? And with every iteration where we say, okay, this time it's different, this time it's real, you know, it's 9/11 and we have to lock down certain things. It's the financial crisis and we have to take, massive action. It's this,
it's also,
it's that.
I would say
we keep coming back to this without giving even any time. I mean, Catherine, you know, you're right that the smart results, and Ron Bailey at Reason has written about this, you know, the way this pandemic is ultimately going to be contained is by individual actors acting smartly and wisely in a voluntary way. This is a massive country. Things are already loose on the landscape. What we need is better information and better direction for how people can act responsibly. That's not going to come from, you know, Bill de Blasio in New York. It's not going to come from Andrew Cuomo, who is bitching and moaning about the, you know, the lack of resources. He didn't do anything to fight this. When you look at the way the governor of Washington, contravened what people were finding in local Seattle hospitals and at nursing homes, at the FDA and the CDC, like, it's, you know, this is a, it's a pandemic where it's up to individuals ultimately to find the way forward. And I think the more that we cede to the government, the worse.
I also want to talk a little bit about epidemic and pandemic inflation, because I think this is something that, you know, Nick, you're right to fear that going forward, but it's also something that we're already living with. So y'all may remember a few months back when it seemed that the entire public health bureaucracy apparatus, the FDA, the CDC, were all bent on the crucial task of fighting the epidemic of vaping, of teen vaping, that people explicitly used the word epidemic, that there were, as you may recall, a few deaths, and that we, like, absolutely went, you know, full bore.
The deaths, we should also recall, were not from the thing they were trying to ban.
The deaths were not, in the end, from the thing they banned. And that, you know, before that, we had the obesity epidemic, which, you know, people were less effective at getting full scale national bans.
The number one problem facing America, right? And our defense apparatus after 9/11, we were constantly told we're too fat.
But this is something that, you know, Reason has certainly written a lot about, something that I feel strongly about, which is that, like, we have abused and overused those words, and also have abused and overused the public health bureaucracy to the point where it's understandable that people, you know, looking for guidance about how to behave when the CDC says, okay, do X, Y, and Z, and that same CDC or the FDA or other players in this space were issuing totally panicked notifications about something that turned out to be, you know, a few tainted vaping cartridges on the black market, it's very, very hard for state actors to have credibility in that circumstance.
And that goes back to the kind of the policy response thing that I was talking about, which is that if you have already, shot all of your bullets, if you have already spent all of your money, if you have already used all of your credibility,
all the dials are already turned up to 11,
right?
Yeah.
on the vaping crisis by, you know, trying to ban the thing that isn't killing people and will probably move vapers towards the thing that might be killing people, then it makes it much harder for policymakers to respond.
I know Matt wants us to move on, but I will say, like, there are some parallels there with the differing responses across different nations to coronavirus. I mean, you know, the fact is, like, maybe closing schools is the equivalent of banning raspberry vape cartridges. We don't exactly know. I don't think it is, but it would be fair to raise that question. It is fair to raise that question. And if it turns out that we have done a massive authoritarian intervention that didn't help, that makes the next crisis even harder to deal with, too.
So, yes, we are going to switch gears here and move to the Democratic response in a moment. But first, the stock market's crashing, oil prices plummeting, socialism, statism rising. As is panic over the coronavirus, the world seems so chaotic that Freedom Fest, your annual summit for the Liberty Movement, is holding a special emergency meeting on Monday, July 13th, right at the kickoff of their annual convention at the Paris Las Vegas. Freedom Fest says the organizers will go on no matter what. And right now, rates are at the lowest you'll see, just $399 for 4 full days. Bring a friend or guest, just $299. Register at www.freedomfest.com before these rates end on March 31st. And now is one hell of a time to get good terms on booking a flight. What will you see once there? Dave Smith, the libertarian comedian and popular podcast host, was just confirmed as this year's Master of Ceremonies. John Stossel will be there, as will at least two of the people on this podcast, I won't say which ones, also Robbie Suave, Corey DeAngelis, and others will participate in a special Reason Day on July 14th. Go to freedomfest.com for all relevant details. Okay, there was a presidential debate last night with social distancing and elbow bumps and two really, really old dudes confusing the current crisis to Ebola and SARS and N1H1 and also H1N1. It was very confusing. I don't know how many of you saw that. I presume all of you, because you're responsible adults and journalists working for the recent superstate. I'll just throw it out first to see among those of you who watched it to come back with anything that jumped out at you. Nick, you go first.
Nothing jumped out at me. Things slowly got out of their chair lift and came at me at an incredibly slow pace. I found it, I watched it faithfully, but it was not a particularly elucidating conversation. I think, you know, Joe Biden at this point has locked in the Democratic nomination. We know what his policies are, and Peter has pointed this out, that Biden is... You know, Biden is campaigning and being taken seriously as a moderate, as a centrist in this campaign. When you compare him even just to what Hillary Clinton was proposing 4 years ago, this guy's a massive expander of government. I think the most interesting thing in the 2020 election at this point is what happens to the Sanders people, because they really don't have a home in the Democratic Party. And I, you know, I look forward to a shift in the way that we talk about politics and political alliances, because they are played out in the current parlance in the same way that libertarians really have very little to, you know, if anything, at home in the current Republican Party. So I'm up for a four-way split into something that's more compelling from a political and ideological mix and match point of view.
Peter, what did you see in terms of a specific either coronavirus response or the health policy aspect of the debate? The thing that jumped out to me was when the one-liner, at least, that remains lodged in what passes from my memory these days, was when Joe Biden said, well, you know, Italy has single-payer healthcare and how they do. What was your assessment of the way that they approached their ideas about health policy in the context of coronavirus?
I'm just glad that either Statler or Waldorf is going to be the Democratic nominee. Really, it's exciting either way. I think in terms of health policy, what struck me most was how little changed in last night's debate relative to other debates. Now, we didn't have, you know, sort of the giant field there to complicate things and to make it a little shoutier. But Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders basically had nothing new to say except for, you know, let's make testing free and let's make people whole. And in terms of actual health policy, they didn't really have good answers on some of the big questions. I don't think Trump has good answers either, which are, how do you deal with surges in the need for capacity, which is what we are looking at and what really the big problem is, it looks like, with COVID-19. Matt, you mentioned at the very beginning of this taping, I think this version of the show, that the governor of New York has already suggested that the New York hospital systems may be overwhelmed. That's the real problem that people are worried about. That's what's going on in Italy. Everywhere there has been really mass, huge issues with COVID-19, it has been because the hospitals have been overwhelmed. Building new hospital capacity, adding respirators, that sort of thing, that doesn't really seem to be on anyone's political agenda. And that is a health policy question that no one is really trying to solve, and that Medicare for All, at very best, wouldn't do any good and might well actually make worse. And so this is a thing that we've talked about before, is that Medicare for All, under most assumptions, it's not technically in Bernie Sanders' bill, but most people who have looked at the plan say, well, look, Medicare for All is going to pay pretty close to Medicare rates across the board. What that means is that hospitals and other healthcare providers would take a huge overall pay cut, since private insurers that exist today pay a lot more than Medicare. And what happens when hospitals take a huge pay cut? They close down. They stop buying stuff. They stop investing in new facilities, in new equipment, in hospital beds, respirators, in people who know how to use that equipment, in ER facilities. And so, you know, if any, like I said, if anything, Bernie Sanders, at very best, Bernie Sanders, well, let's just do Medicare for all, is totally non-responsive to the problem at hand. At worst, it would substantially increase the risk of our hospital systems being overwhelmed and being unable to handle this sort of a pandemic like this in the future.
Catherine, a bit of news that would have been bigger if, you know, the world wasn't a zombie apocalypse. Was apparently Joe Biden said he's going to have a lady
make
veep.
Me answer the lady question. All right.
Oh, do you think I wasn't going to do that?
I should have been ready.
I could do it.
No, I'm on it. I'm ready. So yeah. Biden promised lady veep, and then Sanders kind of said like, it seems very likely that there'll be a lady veep, which I thought was interesting.
Look,
are you going to do it?
If I can find a progressive lady, then I'm open.
Yeah,
to it.
That was what he said. That was a good quote. I thought it was a little bit weird. Like he really said it as like a subordinate clause in the middle of an answer. And then the moderator was like, I'm sorry, did you just? So that was a little bit peculiar. But, you know, overall, this raises my deep, deep sense of alarm that Kamala Harris will rise to a position of great power. On the flip side, the vice presidency is not worth a bucket of warm piss, as we know. And so perhaps this is the safest place she could be in terms of not making Americans' lives worse. That's my silver lining.
Of an 800-year-old man during a pandemic.
Admittedly, this is
good
a concern.
Point.
But at least in the short run, maybe better that than AG. I was struck, as I always am during these debates, by how it's just there. Each debate is just a different kind of bad dinner party that I have been to. And when it was like a million of them and they were all trying to get in and like kind of show off, I was like, yeah, I've been at that dinner party. Terrible. This was a different bad dinner party because it was like the two extremely confident, relatively rhetorically adept old dudes who cannot for the life of them remember any of the specifics of their arguments. So there was so much of them saying like, I'm pretty sure you're ranking with the pro-life, with you voted for on that one bill. They could not recall the deets. And you know what? The details actually don't matter. That was not the main thing that was the point of this debate.
Well, I think they do matter. They just typically have staff and, you know, reference materials.
Right. But also,
to look at,
I mean,
when they need them.
What they were selling was a worldview, and I do think there was a genuine contrast in their worldviews. Even though Joe Biden is not moderate by the standards of the last decade or so, he absolutely is proposing something different than Bernie Sanders. And Bernie Sanders was really explicit. He was like, no, the thing we need is a revolution. And Joe Biden was like, no, the thing we need to do is to fix the thing that's wrong right now. And I actually did appreciate that they got to talk to each other at length about the differences in their worldviews. Still would have been a terrible dinner party.
I think I speak
the
for
thing
Nick,
that, that what... jumped out to me from all of this was just a little bit like what Catherine was saying, was that these guys have been, Joe Biden in particular, has been in the Senate forever. And their whole conversation was just a kind of like Senate beef between two guys who've had to work together for years, and Joe Biden, who just like thinks of every single thing in terms of the Senate club that he has been part of since before I was born. And it's really kind of interesting and telling how defined by that experience and by the weird sort of insulation that it causes and the kind of the way the kind of thinking that it produces, just spending your whole life as one of 100 dudes who kind of gets to like tour the country making speeches and feeling really important and occasionally passing laws.
With the exception of gay marriage, I don't think Joe Biden has really been on the right side of history in anything in his career.
And as Bernie Sanders pointed out last night, Joe Biden was an enthusiastic voter for the Defense of Marriage Act back in 1996 or whenever that was, which was an odious piece of legislation. Go back and read the Reason Archives. contemporaneously about how we approach that issue and compare and contrast to a lot of people who like to congratulate themselves in 2020 of how enlightened they are. Nick, I just wanted to say that Catherine talking about dinner parties and applying it into last night's debate is just a reminder that one of the worst movies ever made was My Dinner with Andre.
It gets worse with every year. It's like a stinking, rotting fish on the plate in front of you, Matt.
My God. I mean, you can't stay awake to any movie, at all, period. But imagine trying to have to stay awake through that bad boy these days. The thing that struck me, I wanted to mention before we start to wind this thing down, was their discussion of fracking and oil drilling. Joe Biden literally said every single debate, he says something that's absolutely like crazy and sweeping. Like, we're going to punish China if it opens up another coal factory. Like, what? How? And last night, he didn't say that. He instead said, we're going to shut down all oil drilling in America. And also no new fracking, whatever that means, but no oil drilling on federal lands in America. Do you realize like what a difference that would make? Both of them were super anti-fracking. Of course, Bernie Sanders wants to ban it immediately. It's as if people look around and see the around 2 million jobs that fracking supports. Entire state economies have been buoyed by this stuff. And if that doesn't move you, because after all, man, the military supports a lot of stuff, jobs too, is that, as I believe Jake Tapper pointed out, the swapping out coal factories for natural gas hydraulic fracturing has been the single greatest contributor towards reducing greenhouse gases or reducing carbon. And America's been a leader on that. It's just it's amazing to me that none of that seems to penetrate or percolate into Democratic earballs. And it happens in every debate. And yet I'm still surprised every time by looking at it. All right, let's wind down since we can't spend all day with one another remotely.
Where are you going? Sure, Matt. Where are you going, man?
I'm going upstairs to see what the bloodshed is like with homeschooling here. Although, you know, again, they've been doing better than I expected. But let's get to a set of our end of show cultural recommendations, specifically with the idea of here is some content to ride out the martial law that Nick Gillespie is enforcing upon all of us.
I am definitely the problem, as are libertarians at society writ large. We have too much influence.
Were you inside my brain, like reading the script? Before we get to that, though, final advertisement here from Freedom Fest. 30 seconds is not enough time to list all the liberty heroes that will be at Freedom Fest this year. Dr. Jordan Peterson, Sir Matt Ridley, Matt and Terry Kibbe, I don't know what honorifics they need, Steve Forbes, Jennifer Grossman, John Fund, Tom Woods, Alyssa Algren, Carrie McDonald, Michael Medved, Vernon Smith, so many more. Check out the growing list and sign up for early bird rates at freedomfest.com. This year's theme is Catch the Vision. So catch that and more at the Paris Las Vegas, July 13th to 16th. The fight for liberty must go on. All right, Nick, what are you tiding over the plague
with? Well, I'll direct people to online copies of Edgar Allan Poe's Mask of the Red Death, which is a great tale of the 1% in a fictional medieval landscape that wall themselves in during the plague. It doesn't end well for them. But more importantly, I watched The Omega Man, the 1971 Charlton Heston apocalyptic movie, which is set in Los Angeles after a chemical weapons bomb has turned most of the people on the planet Earth into mutant albino hippies, who nonetheless are kind of proxies for black people trying to break into Charlton Heston's townhouse in L.A., fantastic movie, and I think people will take some comfort in how ridiculous the apocalypse there seems, even at the time, but especially years later. I think we'll take some comfort from looking at that and recognizing this is not the end of the world, and what will save the world here is not going to be what Andrew Cuomo does. It's going to be what we do as individuals.
Suderman?
I watched Outbreak, the 1995 Wolfgang Petersen film with Dustin Hoffman and Rene Russo and Morgan Freeman. It's on Netflix. It is a kind of 90s throwback thriller that, you know, that takes the scenario that we are in now and then gets virtually every bit of it wrong. Because it, what it assumes is that there's this very deadly disease that kills. I mean, it's a movie. So you end up with, oh, it's 100% mortality in like 48 or 72 hours. And it breaks out in a small town in California in the here in the United States after being brought over from Africa. And then, of course, the whole place is quarantined. The military comes in. And what it turns out is at the end, spoilers. It's a 20-year-old movie. We're all friends here. Spoilers at the end. What it turns out is that the military ends up with this plan to basically napalm the entire town, because what they're trying to do is protect their bioweapon that they had developed.
My God, kill
I don't know whoever it was. Yeah, it's really it's all pretty silly. It's a great example of the kind of 90s thriller that doesn't get made anymore. Michael Crichton wasn't involved in it, but it really feels very Michael Crichton-y, right? In this sort of like science has gotten completely out of control type thing. You know, you've got all of these, like, it's interesting to see Morgan Freeman back when he was merely an old middle-aged man rather than the voice of God. It's a pretty well-made movie in a lot of ways, but it's also, but it just, like I said, it gets every little detail wrong in the, from the deadliness of the disease to the reaction. And this is, I think, the thing that maybe stuck out most to me watching it was the movie is about how people are, about how both the military is overreacts in some ways, and then about how the people in the town where there's the outbreak are just like rioting and they're like crazy and they're, you know, they're so angry and like, and in they're all kind of going nuts. And instead, you go out on streets today in New York and D.C. and L.A., they're somewhat empty. In fact, they're quite empty. There's video of DuPont Circle where Reason's office is, and which would normally be extremely crowded on a Monday morning, and it's just completely empty. And it's just, right, it's the opposite. It's like people are here just sort of saying, oh, well, this is probably not that big a deal. It'll probably pass. We're not going to pay that much attention to it. We're not going to be all that worried. And so it sort of, it misreads the way that that a panic like this or a, you know, an emergency like this actually plays out in the real world. But it's reasonably entertaining. It's on Netflix.
Catherine, what is your virus related to consumption?
My recommendation is both about and useful for our current pandemic. It is the board game Pandemic. I actually recommended this years ago on the podcast. My close friends and family have been playing a version of the game that's called the Legacy Edition. Many board games have this nowadays, strategy games especially, which is as you play, the game evolves. So you open up little boxes or new cards or stickers to put on the board. Pandemic Legacy is structured by months. So you are, time is passing and you are trying to fight a series of epidemics. It is a collaborative epidemiological game. And if ever there was a moment for such a thing, now is it. If you're going to play this game, stop listening for a second now, because I do want to do a small spoiler. There are two seasons, by the way.
So it's like you can, sim epidemic?
Sort of. There are two seasons. In the first season, in Pandemic Legacy Season 1, you will start to play and you will think, okay, I need to use a kind of martial law type response. Then there will be a big reveal and you might regret that choice. I've been thinking a lot about how my nice group of well-intentioned people that included like a nurse and a consultant and a person who helps teach children and me, who you can describe probably less charitably, we were all trying to do our best and we still imposed martial law all around the world. And that was not the right call for reasons that would become apparent as you continue to play. Okay, spoilers are over, but honestly, all I can think about is how that board game is going down and whether or not that's where we are in the real world. It's a great game. You should play it. It takes a long time. Good luck.
So my recommendation is only tangentially related to the theme. And even that, if you stretch, but so spending a lot of quality time with my family these days. And so our latest family movie night at the request of the 11-year-old was to watch the Greatest Showman, the biopic-ish thing, musical, Hugh Jackman, about P.T. Barnum. And it's actually not going to be my recommendation, although it's a perfectly fine movie. And basically, I think Zendaya is the greatest, and she's going to be a huge star. But so there were some follow-up questions by various family members about the details of P.T. Barnum's life. And so I'm like, oh, let me just fire up the old Wikipedia here and look at it. And oh my God, was there a really good movie that didn't get made about what a dude that guy was. This is in the same theme I recommended a couple of weeks back, the Current War, which is a immediately vanished pick from last year-ish about the fight between Thomas Edison and George Westinghouse. Really interesting. So in the same kind of 19th century, you know, we're about ready to start, doing industrial revolutions and just do all kinds of weird stuff. P.T. Barnum is a little bit before that, but like, the movie is sort of just it puts him as a guy who wants to impress the swells because he was treated like garbage as a kid, and so that's his chip on the shoulder. And that plus, you know, he is mostly nice to the cast-offs of society, the end kind of thing. And here's a bunch of great songs. The actual P.T. Barnum like started a newspaper when he was young, like in 1829. Challenged the local clergy for being a bunch of sellouts. They went after him for libel. He spends 2 months in the pokey, comes out even a bigger champion of liberalism, is an early switcher from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party on the issue of slavery. Although his first Carney Act, I think, was some like 5-year-old that he bought into slavery. It's all such a crazy mess. He founded more or less the city of Bridgeport, Connecticut, which he was the mayor of and a legislator, I think, as well. He opened the first aquarium, because why not? Amazing life. And now all I want to do is like read biographies of P.T. Barnum.
Can
and how
I
awesome
just
is.
Suggest that people Google P.T. Barnum at reason.com. John Mueller years ago wrote an essay about how P.T. Barnum essentially created business ethics in America. It was a review of a new edition of his autobiography that was released some years ago, I think by Southern Illinois State Press. But Barnum is widely seen as a scam artist, but he, in fact, in his autobiography, talked about how you can either take people's money once by ripping them off or giving them what they actually want and then creating a win-win kind of situation in business. But look up P.T. Barnum at reason.com. There's a great essay there that speaks to many of the things that you're talking about, Matt.
I think just now when you said Google P.T. Barnum at Reason, yeah, that was that had a little bit of a like go to the YouTube,
yeah, sure,
from Bernie
absolutely
last night vibe. Yeah. So just be vigilant, Nick.
As part of that, I think P.T. Barnum invented the word humbug, which you might think is ironic, or strange, considering he's sort of accused of that. But he saw these differentiations in a way that's super interesting and has influence on marketing and different types of things. Just like super interesting. Great. Can't recommend it more. Okay. I hope that 7 days from now, we'll be happier. It's hard to imagine that given the trend lines of everything. But at any rate, we're going to keep cranking out content. This is the first time that we've had a four-way, four-location, I believe, podcast here. So bear with us as we deal with the technological challenges. But otherwise, we're pretty well set up and resilient to handle that and other things. And we'll still be cranking out podcasts at reason.com/podcasts on the YouTubes, including the Wednesday interview with Nick Gillespie and such like. So keep tuning in, and we will do our level best to try to share good information and good analysis out there. And we'll catch you back next Monday. Goodbye.